we have come to a stage in our studies in the synthesis of yoga where I believe it will be useful to have a certain clarification of the terms that we will be using rather frequently from now on. I thought of this after one or two discussions that I have had during the last 2 weeks with a Protestant pastor who preaches from the pulpit in one of the churches in Pondicherry. And he wanted to understand some of the implications of Sri Aurobindo's and Mother's philosophy. And he put me certain questions regarding the significance or the connotation of terms which mean different things in Christian theology and quite differently in Sri Aurobindo's philosophy. Let us be clear regarding certain key terms that we are using. As you are aware, there is first an absolute, a reality which cannot be described in human speech, which is infinite, which is ineffable. When that reality reveals itself to our uplooking human intelligence, the mind, the highest human mind, has received it as an eternal self-existence. And that existence is not an inert existence, but a fully conscious, self-aware existence. It is a consciousness. And the nature of this consciousness is bliss, uncaused delight. So, the reality, the absolute reality, reveals itself to the human consciousness as existence, consciousness, bliss. Now, this triune reality, as related to our manifestation, as related to this universe, that is its manifestation, appears in another set of three at the next level. It is the self. The self that sustains everything, what in Indian philosophy we call Atman. It is just there, behind every form, every creature, every formation, there is the self as the bedrock of that formation. This is the self, whether on an individual basis or on a cosmic basis. Second, there is the conscious being, the spirit that takes cognizance, what we call in Indian philosophy the Purusha, the person. Third is God, the divine being, what we call in Indian philosophy Ishvara. Now this triple presentation, self-revelation of the reality as the self, as the conscious being, as God, the divine being, has, when looked at from the point of their working, they have three powers, each relative to the particular manifestation. When it is the self that bases all existence, when it is Brahman who is all existence, the power that acts, Brahman himself has power, the self has power, is the conceptively creative puissance called Maya. Mark that Maya in the pristine original Indian tradition does not mean a power of illusion. It rather means the power that conceives, and in the very act of conception it formulates. It comes from the root ma, to measure. It measures the immeasurable. It brings out the finite from the infinite. This element of cleverness, of cunning in bringing out measured formations from what is truly immeasurable has given it the name Maya. As from the point of the conscious being, the Purusha, the same power becomes the executive power. Either what the Purusha wills or what it would impose on the Purusha, it is the executive power, the Prakriti, that functions. As at the level of the divine being, Ishvara, God, the power of God is called Shakti. So these three sets, Atman, Purusha, Ishvara, Maya, Prakriti and Shakti, these are the three pairs, he and himself as she. They are not two separate, like the sun and the sunlight, the fire and the power of burning, God and his Shakti, Purusha and his Prakriti, the self and his Maya. These three always go together. With this clarification, I was asked by the gentleman of whom I was speaking, why we fight shy of the term God? Why do we use the word divine? I explained to him that as far as the mother is concerned, she prefers to avoid the word God in view of the traditional association in the West of many things with the concept of God. God has been imaged in the West and also in some traditions in the East, in the figure of man, something anthropomorphic. He is given qualities limited by his expression. He is something like a huge man. Now mother wanted to cut off from this association. That is why she has chosen to use the word divine. Then he asked, why do you call truth? What exactly is the connotation of truth? Well, truth is not what is truth in ethics or morality. Speaking the truth, speaking as things are, that is not the truth in philosophy. Truth in philosophy, at any rate, in our philosophy, means the reality of things. What is real, whether apparent or not, that is true. Ultimately, it is the divine that is real. Therefore, the divine is the truth, and truth is the divine. Third, he asked, what is the content of the term surrender that you use? He said, in the Bible, the word surrender is not there, though in other Christian writings, later on, the word surrender occurs. But the connotation is always one of what he said was that it signifies a certain sense of defeat, of going under. I explained to him that when Sri Aurobindo used the word surrender for a concept, Indian concept, he said the English word surrender can only inadequately render the meaning that I have in mind. What Sri Aurobindo and the mother mean when they speak of surrender is not the meaning that the Oxford Dictionary gives, but an attitude, not so much an act, but an attitude of self-giving, self-consecration, a working out of the impulse and the determination to put oneself in tune with something else. Self-giving, self-offering, self-consecration. This is the content of surrender. With this background, I think we can take up today the chapter from the synthesis, the modes of the self. You know now what is the self. The self that we speak is not that vague entity of which the book speaks behind our psychological being, but it is the eternal being behind the whole manifestation. It is that self that gives meaning to everything that is built or builds itself around it. That is why in one of the oldest Upanishads, the disciple, when he approaches his teacher, asks, speak to me of that by knowing which all this will be known. So that self, the self of all creation, that is to be known. known not in an intellectual way, not by having mental ideas, metaphysical conceptions, but known, seen, known and held in the consciousness. That is true knowledge. Otherwise, it is a mental baggage. When, by means appropriate to this kind of knowledge, your consciousness gets a glimpse, absorbs the nature of the self and is one with it at some point, at least to begin with, that is knowledge. Naturally, the knowledge of that which is above mind can only be got by a faculty which is above the mind. But it is not that one has to wait till one crosses in his yoga across the mind. We have points of contact, centers of consciousness, which are even now at this stage in everybody. Openable to those higher planes where this knowledge obtains. It is possible by silencing the mind, by lighting up the fire of aspiration in the heart, to receive the knowledge of the self intuitively, in flashes, or as a slow revelation, a solid mass builds itself in the consciousness. One simply becomes aware of it, which is more concrete than any knowledge that you can build with the help of logic and reason. One has to start with certain mental conceptions, true, but one can't stop them. The first step, the first part of this knowledge of the self is to realize that all here are the self. Not only each form is the self in a sense, but all together are part of the self. The self is not exhausted by any number of forms or formations. It is looming over all the forms. But on that account, the forms, the individual souls, the individual formations are not a whit less true than the self. They are in fact projections of the self. The individual unit, the individual soul has a reality, an intrinsic reality, which is of the same order, in a sense, as of the self. It was fashionable in Indian philosophical history and, as a matter of fact, in Asian history also. Among the Buddhists, among the followers of monism in India, to say that there is no soul as such. He said, it is merely a bundle of sensations, samskaras, at the physical level, the life level, the mental level, all held together by the thread of desire. That creates an illusion of a substantive entity. In the followers of monism also, tended in practice, whatever they may say in theory, to devalue the status of the soul by saying it has no real independent existence. It thinks it exists, it imagines it lives, but the moment knowledge dawns, like the waking up from a dream, it finds that it exists no more. It has disappeared in the Brahman. Now these are rather extreme views which perhaps have certain justification in certain types of spiritual experience which are certainly not the ultimate. But the point is that each soul is a projection of the self. The divine reality consents to reflect itself on so many planes of existence as souls, soul existences. Sri Aurobindo humorously recalls the protest of the devotee lover of God who said, who affirmed and insisted upon maintaining his identity, spiritual identity, by saying that he wants to eat sugar and not become sugar. This gives in a nutshell the whole raison d'etre of manifestation from a certain angle. The divine spreads itself out, throws itself in 1,000 fragments in order that it can have the delight of union, the delight of the bliss of union with what is apparently separate from itself. That is called the play. Someone asked the other day, why do they call it Leela, play? It is this, it is a game of the one bifurcating itself into two and more and getting together in order to have the thrill, the joy of union. So this reality of the individual soul against the background of the self is a point to be remembered. Second, this self that is manifesting has three statuses: as projected in my soul, which is active, which is participating in this world, in this life, it is called the mutable Purusha, mutable self. It changes. It participates in experience, it grows, it goes its trace, it moves, it lends itself to all kinds of mutation as part of its experience. But this is not all. If it were only that, one would go on always mutating. But behind this mutable self, there is the reserve of the immutable self. There is an immense reservoir of silence, of power, of bliss, which only a fraction of it comes and acts in the mutable. As one grows spiritually, in this dynamic yoga of fulfillment, one does touch certain depths of this immutable self, where one feels free from involvement, but not a non-existence, but a full charge of power held in reserve. these two, the mutable self and behind it the immutable, they strike the human mind as opposite poles, irreconcilable opposites. But to a higher knowledge, to a perception that goes beyond the vision of the logical reason, there is a third status, the status of the Supreme Purusha, the transcendent, in which both these meet. In fact, both the mutable and the immutable are complementary aspects of the transcendent when he turns towards the manifestation. Each individual in this line of yoga has to realize these three possible statuses. And once one realizes this triple status of the manifesting self, there is no more warring of philosophies. It is common among philosophers to argue, debate and fight. Some say that all is one. There is only God, there is only the divine. That's the only truth. Man is not, the world is not. So, when one realizes the truth, there is only the divine and nothing else. Another set school of philosophers, they say, not monism, but dualism is the nature. There is always a dichotomy between God and man, soul and nature, heaven and earth. Whatever the state of your realization, man cannot become one with God. This is common both to certain schools of Hindu philosophy and also the Christian thought. It is a blasphemy for them to say that man can become one with God. Here, there are certain fanatics in India who would cut you down if at all you were to say that man can one day evolve to the status of God. They say, no, you may develop a nature which resembles his. You may acquire the right to be near, a salvation that takes you near his presence. You can perhaps live in the same world as he does, but becoming one with him, you can never. Then there is a third school, which is called the qualified monism, which says, true, that man is created by God, he is not a separate entity, not a separate category. He is dependent upon God. Both man and nature are dependent upon God, but they are always separate. This too has its own adherence. Now, Sri Aurobindo says that all the three answer to three distinct possibilities of experience and realization. One can have all these realizations in one's life. At a certain level of experience, one can feel oneself and enjoy the relation of being separate from God. Be the lover of God, be the servant of God, be the instrument of God. But that does not shut out from him the possibility, the reality of his being in another plane, in another poise, one with the divine, one with the God. Similarly, he can feel the distinction in manifestation, but be all the while conscious of his dependence upon the Divine. So all the three realizations are possible for a conscious human soul to realize in the same life. In fact, for a fulfilled, fully realized being, say, one who holds the Divine Consciousness like the Mother or Sri Aurobindo, all the three are simultaneously active. All the three realizations are simultaneously living. Next, we spoke of the one and the many, of the three statuses of the self. Then there is another aspect of the modes of the self, and that is whether it is personal or impersonal. Here again, the contradictions are only posed by the limited mind. The Divine Self has all the qualities, can put out any number of qualities from itself, but all the while it is free from those qualities. The qualities do not limit it. Similarly, it can throw itself in action, but also it can be free from action. It is because of this inherent freedom to act or not to act, to manifest or not to manifest a quality, that it is capable of infinite variety of action, infinite variety of quality. Similarly, whether the Supreme is a person or an impersonal state, say power, peace, bliss, this also is a mental problem. For one who has a sufficiently comprehensive spiritual realization, the question looks academic, because both the personal and the impersonal are truths of the Divinity. The impersonal is a state of existence. The personal is the existent. The existence of what? Of him who exists. So the personal is there, but the base is an impersonal state. The personal projection or formation does not exhaust the possibility. There is always the personal the lines of the form of the personal. I'm not getting the word. I wouldn't say peter off. Fade away. The demarcations of personality, they just fade away lightly into the impersonality that is the base. For the integral seeker, he must start with this mental knowledge. The authentic knowledge given by those who have obtained that knowledge in life, that all these modes of the self are true and real. My experience of one mode does not preclude your experience of another mode, or preclude my own future experience of another possible mode. All these modes are true. The personal and the impersonal, the active and the passive, the qualitied and the unqualitied. Similarly, the mutable, the immutable, and the transcendent. All these are to be taken into account when you consider the relations of the self with this phenomenal world, which is not really a creation, but a projection of the Supreme Self. Questions? The term he has used from the tantric context. The yoga maya in the tantras means the power of formation that the yogic shakti takes. It is a way of calling yoga shakti, the yoga power. Here, when you use the word maya instead of shakti, it emphasizes the aspect of unexpected wonders, unexpected results being turned out by the yoga force. Yes, the Supreme Self projects itself in so many individual souls, as also in so many collectivities. In the individual, the soul starts forming pretty earlier. But in the collectivity, since the consciousness is not so much articulate, the soul takes time. So even the collective soul is a purposive projection of the manifesting soul of the universe. It is a part of it, intended to bring out, to express a certain special stress of that particular group of souls who are living in that collectivity. Speaking of group soul, I was very much amused when about 3 weeks ago I received a letter from one of the institutions, newly formed, I believe, institutions in the United States. They had come to know and that I had taken the editorship of the World Union Journal, and they wrote a nice letter welcoming me and assuring me of their cooperation. I liked all that very much. And then at the end they said, "You speak the World Union Journal, you speak of the group soul, which we are sure means human nature. We will have plenty to collaborate." Now, certainly the group soul does not mean human nature. They think human nature is the same everywhere. So there is a certain commonality which gives a ground for all to work together. Whether it is worth it to make clear what we mean by group soul, whether it will be understood in the West, I am not sure, I am hesitating. I would welcome a suggestion from Cyril, whether I could write the next editorial. I am due to write next month for the next issue.
All the clarity.
You were talking about the view.
Say, there can't be exact correspondence, you know. This mutable, immutable and the transcendent is given in the Gita. And Sri Aurobindo refers to it in the context of the Gita. And there can't be exact correspondences between different systems. But if your mind would be a little flexible, I would say the psychic being which is involved in evolution, participating in experience, acting and reacting, known or unknown to you, that may be equated for our purpose of our understanding with the inner mutable Purusha. But behind the psychic, there is the self, which is unmoved, which does not participate, which witnesses everything. That is the immutable. And still above, there is what Sri Aurobindo would call the central being. Above, overseeing the whole affair, that perhaps could answer to the description of the transcendent. The self is behind, the psychic is in the front, the self is behind, but the jivatman, the central being, is above. It is a projection of that central being which is unloaded in the circle of evolution that forms the soul or the psychic being. I think this triple truth, mutable, immutable and transcendent, repeats itself at every level. In our mind, for instance, there is the part of the mind which is active. There is a part of the mind which is silent. There is a still deeper part which holds both together and coordinates them. So at every level, mind, life, emotions, a part which is involved, a part which supports, a part which presides over. The first business for all of us is to become conscious of the part which is not involved. After being conscious, to place a part of our consciousness or awareness in that uninvolved part, and from there function, so that there is a practical bifurcation in the being, one part frontally acting, the other watching and supporting, untired, uninvolved from behind. The outer vital Purusha, the inner vital Purusha, and the divine being presiding over the vital manifestation. We will be coming later, I think, in one of the chapters, how the divine self is manifest in all the three statuses at each level. So it is the one self that is called the mental Purusha at one level, the vital Purusha, the physical Purusha. And on that each level again, the outer being, the inner being, and the deepest.
Does the deepest group?
The deepest one is same. I was just about to say it. As long as our awareness is confined to the surface, it is not possible. But on our own being, there is a level which is transcendent of this manifestation. Each one of us has a station in the transcendent. We are not conscious of it. Once we develop an integral, a multiple consciousness, add all the number of dimensions that are possible for the manifest consciousness, that transcendent status lends itself to be felt and experienced. Transcendent, not of, it is not that you can't experience it. Transcendent means it is not involved in the moment. It is there. The moment of manifestation, the moment of the universe, it is not involved, it is not affected. But it supports it. It is not aloof. It is not turned away. It supports. That is the difference between Shankara's philosophy and Sri Aurobindo. He says the Absolute is not turned away from the universe. The universe has been projected from the Absolute and the Absolute supports it. Absolute has come, the universe has come out of the bosom of the Absolute. So it is possible, if only one develops a multiple consciousness, to be aware.
Is that why the intellect?
Exactly. It comprehends both horizontally and vertically. The full extent of the being and the becoming. The world mind is rapidly turning towards this realization of unity. We do not have to build this world unity by human effort. The mother says that the world unity has been fashioned already. It is ready at the doors of the physical universe, waiting for the veil to be removed. The veil consists in the human egoism, division, and refusal to part on the part of each nation from its element of division. That is why nature is forcing the nations to come together, to clash, whether in clash or in harmony, it does not matter. They are being brought together, shocked into oneness. And it was inconceivable, say 20 years ago, that this much of commonness, oneness, unity would be possible. If today sworn enemies like America and China can sit together at the table, if Russia and America can sit together and leave aside the points of dispute, meet in the areas of agreement, That surely is a pointer. I do not agree with people who say that the UNO is a failure and it has to be abolished. Sri Aurobindo warned against this facile assumption long ago. He said, the League of Nations was doomed to go because of its inherent contradictions. So another cataclysm had to take place and the UNO came. If the UNO has to go and another world body has to take its place, it means another world war has to come. And it is my most clear conviction that a world war hereafter is impossible. With the descent of the truth consciousness in 1956, a world conflagration can be safely ruled out. There may be local battles and wars, of which one realizes the futility on the third day or the fourth day, and the forces of harmony again bring them together. But there cannot be world war. There is no alternative to the UNO. The UNO has to be mended and not ended. And there is an acceptance of this approach at the top levels, whether in the communist bloc or in the other non-communist bloc. There is no alternative. And if the yogic transformation that is being precipitated in the mother's body goes at its expected speed, it is bound to have repercussions even on the level, political level, of human unity. Almost the very phrases which we think here, the very expressions we read in journals that are being published in the States, how do you explain it? There is already an impact in the realm of ideas. They may say we are borrowing their expressions, we may say they are borrowing, but the truth is those things are descending, and whoever is open receives those expressions, because they are the majus, the right words for the truths that are descending.
Is that what mother means when you?
Yes. Because this yoga is a collective yoga and not an individual yoga. So, even our minus contributions also affect humanity adversely. A kind of a focus where anything that happens has its reactions on the cosmic scale. Greater harmony, understanding between the inmates, whether in ashram or in Auroville, will be a positive factor towards the change of consciousness in humanity. Growth of falsehood, disharmony and ill will and lack of faith amongst us will delay the consummation on the universal scale. The same 50 or 60 of us, if we were to live somewhere else, our behavior would not at all matter for the collective evolution of the world. It is because here a concentrated force is operating. All of us who constitute the field of that force take on a certain representative character, and we have a certain responsibility to our Maker, who has brought us here, who is maintaining us here, to keep up our part of the implied agreement.